Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. My guest today is Tyler O'Shea, who's been running a sports publication called Joker Mag for the last 6.5 years. He tells me that the website gets some 50,000 page views per month, the newsletter has around 13,000 subscribers, and all the socials combined have over 22,000 followers. His focus is underdog sports stories, which clearly resonate with people. And I wanted to interview him because I really resonated with an earnesty and drive in how he presents himself and his content online. We'll get into his origin story soon. It's a good one. It could not set up why he does what he does more perfectly. But anyways, Tyler, in your own words, who is Tyler O'Shea and what does he do?
My name is Tyler O'Shea and I run JokerMag.com. And you described it perfectly. It's basically the home of inspiring underdog stories in sports. And my entire life, I've kind of been infatuated with stories like that. Always loved when kind of ESPN would have a little like side breakdown of a player with a great story. And I figured why not build a place to house kind of all of those stories in one place.
Yeah. Going back to like the origin story a bit, because I do want to talk about that, and we don't need to like, you know, rehash it all because you've documented it very well. But I think it's rare to find someone like, I think all the best creators, right? Like, do what they do and have the energy to keep doing it for years because it's something they really care about and are interested in. But like my understanding is in like seventh grade, you were trying out for the baseball team at school and you got cut and, you know, it sucked and you're upset. But so you like kind of sought out some of these underdog stories online from just like baseball, other sports, and that really inspired you. And that's kind of why you do what you do, correct?
Exactly. Yeah. And baseball was my life pretty much all my whole life, pretty much through college. It's been everything to me. Like my dad played baseball through college, my brother and myself. But yeah, that day getting cut, like I honestly deserved to, like I was smaller than the other kids. Like I was taking curl hops from shortstop, like really just not able to swing the bat well. Like it was a heavier bat at the time. Yeah, I mean, I just remember going up, like, I guess a day or two later, up to my parents' room. We had one, like, old desktop computer in the house.
Oh, I missed those days, up there. The computer room.
Exactly. And I was just searching the web, and I was like, Tim Lincecum was big at the time, a big pitcher for the Giants, and he was a smaller guy. David Eckstein, Dustin Pedroia, guys like that. And I was just kind of looking for that hope of, like, is it possible for a guy like me at my size to, you know, make my dream come true and just continue playing baseball as long as I possibly could. And I did. I found that evidence there that kind of provided that hope for myself and kind of instilled like an extra bit of confidence in me to kind of double down and just say, all right, it might not happen this year, but it's going to happen next year and whatever. And then just throughout the years, I've kind of progressed and grew and ended up playing through college at McDaniel College.
Nice. So something about like the athlete mentality, I think, and the creator mentality and the founder mentality. And I would say like the way you operate Joker Mag, you're kind of between media founder and creator. I'd almost call you more like a media founder. But anyways, all that to say, back in February, I interviewed this woman, Jade Buffon Phillips, who is a lifelong athlete. She did track and field stuff. And she's a creator and she's a founder. And her content, maybe you read this one, her content is about being a founder. And I was really struck by like the relationship between being an athlete, being a creator, being a founder, and it's all this like overcoming adversity and you know, just like having to deal with like the odds being against you. So I'd love if you could speak more to like how those things connect and if you agree that like the mentality for all those things is fundamentally the same.
I 100% agree. I think recently I had a conversation with a colleague of mine at work, and he was saying like, don't overlook the athlete background. I think it's something that now that I'm in my late 20s, I've kind of forgotten about. Like, I don't really talk about it much on my resume and stuff like that. And it's like, baseball is a game of failure. Like 7 times out of 10, you can fail and you're a great player. So I think just the mental toughness that builds of like, just knowing that you're going out there and you're going to fail a lot and you're going to make yourself look bad. Like, I coached briefly after college as an assistant hitting coach for a local college near us. And I always told my players this story of like this, my first playoff game in college, I struck out every single time I went to the plate. My whole family was there. And it was like, honestly, like the most embarrassing performance of my entire baseball career. And I was like, I couldn't even look like my family in the eye. I was like,
didn't show up to the big game.
Exactly. And it was like, that was kind of another pivotal point where it's like, okay, you know, you could have a terrible day, but you know, 2 days later we had another playoff game and I had to mentally reset myself. And ended up having a much better game. But it's like, in the world of, you know, media or whatever you're building, like you're going to have those moments where you're down and things aren't going your way, but you just need to consistently get after it and just kind of stay mentally sharp, I guess. Like, don't get too high, don't get too low. And that's definitely what baseball taught me.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. I wasn't an athlete growing up. My family just wasn't a sports family. I've turned out all right, but sometimes I regret that. Like, my biggest regret in life is my mom signed me up for soccer in first grade and I complained and she acquiesced and didn't make me do it. So maybe I learned that. Maybe I learned like how to, you know, overcome failure through playing video games, which is what I did instead. But anyways, all that to say, after college, you graduated and then you started doing Joker Mag right around the same time. And then maybe about 2 years later, you started working in SEO. So we'll get there, but I want to go back to that origin point. And like, you told me over email that you basically didn't know what you wanted to do for a career, but you did want to just write about things you enjoyed. So two questions about that. First, why were you like always somebody who wanted to write? What drive you to writing as opposed to like YouTube or podcasting?
Yeah. So my teachers kind of in all through middle school and high school kind of told me like, hey, we think you have a little bit of a talent for writing. And it was always like the class I enjoyed most. And to be totally honest, like right after college, I was not a great writer. Like I was used to like essay form writing and like long form and just kind of like fluffing things up. So it definitely took a lot of time to learn how to write for the internet and for an audience in sports. But I started writing like immediately after graduating for a local Philly sports publication. It was like kind of an upstart and it was all like volunteer work. And it was just a way to get some articles published under my own name. And from there, I was like, why not start my own thing? Like where I have total creative freedom. I always loved Bill Simmons, his old website, Grantland.com. And then The Ringer was starting up around that point. And it was just really cool. Like I would find myself, like you said earlier, just like reading long form stories. I was just obsessed with just clicking over and I'm like, okay, I'm clicking all these links and I'm like, man, I have like 10 tabs open right now on this one website. And it's like, I'm going down the rabbit hole and I wanted to make somewhere where people could have that experience too. So it really didn't start with too much of a vision. It was just like, I want to write about things I enjoy. And then eventually it kind of narrowed down to the theme I'm focused on now.
Yeah, no, that's, I really like that. I think the like not being good at writing or like having this style or like not necessarily not being good, but like not knowing how to do the thing that you ended up doing now. Like when I graduated college, I also like wanted to be a writer, but I couldn't make myself write. I didn't know like how to write outside of like writing essays for school, which I was good at, but it's like, who's going to give me the essay prompts now, you know? And it took me years to get past that. So I really like that. So after that, you started doing that. And then eventually what you do now for your day job is you do SEO. You start as an SEO consultant, and now I think you work full-time in-house at a brand. I think SEO is a very anxiety-ridden profession because it's always like the big Google update is coming out. Like, what the hell are we going to do? Is this going to, you know, render all of our work null and void? And these days, obviously, there's, I think, an even bigger looming anxiety, not just for SEO, but for SEO as well, about AI search, Google generating AI snippets. Not to get like too deep in the weeds of SEO, but I don't know, are you feeling that anxiety? Maybe both in relation to your day job, but also the fact that Joker Mag is like an empire built on SEO. Like, are you nervous about this?
So people always ask me that, and I was actually going back and forth yesterday with a few friends of mine in the SEO space, and Google just announced that they're rolling out these AI, like they're calling them AI overviews. We've known them as search generative experience.
This is like the thing at the top of the
stuff. Exactly. Yeah. Those little snippets. The results have been mixed in my experience. Like I've been testing it for the past, I think 3 or 4 months now. It's been rolled out to like people that, I don't know if people have a Google Analytics account, I guess they give you access. But long story short, no, I've never really worried about Google updates. I think search will always exist. Like the way people use the internet is to search for things mainly. Even on like TikTok and stuff, people are searching. Like I'll talk to my fiance now and it's like, I'll tell her like, look up this recipe. Like we want to make this cool dinner tonight. She doesn't open up Google. She opens up TikTok or Instagram or whatever. And I think people are always going to be seeking things out. It's just a matter of how you approach that and reverse engineer that in terms of an SEO strategy. So I think it'll always be around. It just depends on what form. And I think, you know, strategies will always be changing and evolving in response to those changes in the market.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I think with the recipe thing is really interesting because I hear people talk about TikTok search or Instagram search, or to look up a recipe, like you said. But like when I look up a recipe, I'll look up like recipe blank Serious Eats in Google, Serious Eats, because I trust Serious Eats and that's somewhere I've been a lot. Okay. But I'm wondering if like, I'll like bookmark recipes on you know, I'm not much on TikTok, but like on Instagram, there's like so many Instagram every day. There's like a new recipe I want to bookmark, etc. But I'm never going back, kind of just realizing now, to cook them. And I wonder if that's just like almost a thing where like in 10 years, though, there's going to be nobody who had like learned about Serious Eats by like reading some article online. So they're just going, and now Serious Eats is just like an Instagram page where you go and save recipes. Cause I don't know, now I'm just rambling a bit, but I think for me, like it's still so much more intuitive to go to a website and have that on my phone rather than like open an Instagram reel and like pull up the comments or the caption where the essay is. I don't know. There's no question in here, but yeah, what do you think?
I think you brought up a great point of like brand trust. And I think that's the main thing that with Joker Mag, kind of bringing it back to there, is like, my goal is not to bring in like search traffic forever. I want eventually the search traffic to like kind of go down and direct and returning visitors to be like my main source. Because I think that's true fans, like people that are coming directly, have your site bookmarked, like you said, and they're just coming back for that endless stream of content. And that's kind of what the newsletter is about too, is just like building up my base of true fans and people that really are hungry and starving for the content that I'm putting out. And I think, you know, the market size, the market potential, I think I ran the numbers, like number of MLB fans is like 150 million or something. If I could just capture like 1% of that, I could have a major, you know,
but that's the hard part, right? Cause then it's like, what about like The Athletic or The Ring? Like I go to The Athletic. I'm a soccer fan. I watch the Premier League. And so every morning I open up The Athletic and I go to the Arsenal tab, the Premier League tab and the Champions League tab. So like what's, you know, you mostly cover like baseball and football, I believe. What's stopping? Why does somebody go? Who is your true fan, and why do they go to Joker Mag rather than The Athletic or The Ringer, whatever?
That's a great question. It's something that over the past year I've learned a lot more about, of like who my readers are. It tends to be men 35 and up who are based in the U.S. and just love these specific type of stories. Like there are people that might read The Athletic or people that maybe don't even pay attention to like these score updates on a weekly basis. Just people that want that kind of, I guess, dopamine hit of like an inspirational story, feel good stories.
Cause you're not doing like the scores. Like there's no need to go to you for that.
We're not in the news business at all. At the bottom of a newsletter, I might plug like a feel good, like topical news story if there's something good out there, but it just tends to be people that just love like the off the field stories and then kind of the narratives that inspire you and motivate you to kind of improve in some aspect of your own life or maybe something you can relate to. Recently we did a story about a guy that was born with some type of disability and he's in a wheelchair and he has now created his own sport of like wheelchair motocross, it's called.
That's amazing.
And it's amazing. Like the guy, like he goes on tour with Travis Pastrana, who's a big name out there in this whole extreme sports field. And he does like double back flips and he's like constantly pushing the envelope. And it's like, he invented his own space for himself. And then I got so much great feedback from my readers of like, this is an amazing story. Like I never heard of this sport, obviously. And like, you know, a couple people that might be in a wheelchair have read my stories and said like, oh, this particular story really struck a nerve with me because it's not really out there as much. And it's something I can personally relate to, or just someone that, you know, just finds that type of story inspiring in whatever challenge that they're facing personally.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. like, speaking of that story in particular, I am curious how you source your stories. Like, cause I know you have, you do some original interviews and then you do some that are like stories that are out there that you're like taking and repackaging a bit. Do you have like just like a big list of like 500 stories where it's like, okay, I'll get to this one and this one's scheduled for then? Like, question is, how do you source your content? How do you find these stories?
Exactly. Yeah. I have a list of like 500 plus in a spreadsheet. Just kind of track like the original sources where I found them. A lot of them come now through reader recommendations. So a reader will reply and say, hey, you should cover this person's story. So it's kind of like an endless stream of content ideas. Like, I kind of have that privilege. Like, when I listen to your other podcasts, like, people sometimes mention like a challenge of, you know, coming up with content ideas and how it's sometimes a challenge. But that's the fortunate thing, is that these are evergreen stories usually. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just an endless, like, nonstop funnel of these coming in. Whether it's throughout history, like if I just focused on like the 1950s, like, that could be my entire business if I wanted to. So, there's so many great stories like throughout sports history and every sport. And we're just focused on like really putting everything in one place, like not only for like just all these stories, but also like the person's story. We want to pull from multiple sources and kind of make the most comprehensive narrative about that person. So I really pride myself in my research and just like kind of pulling from different sources, videos, podcasts, books that they've written or been a part of, to just kind of go the extra mile to tell the best story possible.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I think too, like, just thinking of the underdog concept, like I said, I didn't grow up in a sports family and such, but in the past year, since the 2022 World Cup, is when I've like gotten really into watching soccer and watch it every weekend. But before that, like before I like picked like, oh, a team I'm going to follow, et cetera, it was always just like, well, who's the underdog? Like, I remember watching the 2022 World Cup. It's like, everyone's talking about Morocco because they're like the first African nation to like get that far in the cup, and it's, and they're doing so well and overperforming, et cetera. And like, I think that's where kind of your broad appeal then is, right? Because like, your average sports fan who's not overly invested in any specific team or narrative is almost always going to assert, like, I mean, it's more fun to support the underdog than to support, you know, the team that always wins, right? Like, do you agree?
Yeah, I've always been that way. And I've met people in college, that was like the first time that like I roomed with like a Boston fan, and it was like they were on like the hottest run ever. It was like, you know, Patriots were winning, Red Sox were winning, and it's like just nonstop winning. I'm like, doesn't this get boring for you, man? Like let's root for like a team that, you know, is kind of like the underdog. So I've kind of always had that spirit in me, and I think it probably just comes from my personal experience, but I think it is kind of an innate human thing to root for the underdog, David versus Goliath and stuff like that.
True. So, this goes back, I think, too, to the whole thing about like the origin story. It's like, don't you want to root for like the underdog, somebody who's, because it's like, you want some adversity, you want some struggle, and life is about a little struggle, you know. You don't want everything on a plate, you want to chew your food a little bit, right?
Yeah. And I mean, in college I learned about the hero's journey, like Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, and that's kind of something I come back to from time to time too, is like every big movie throughout history has been that same cycle of like they refuse the call to action, and then it's like they go through all this adversity, and then they overcome something that no one ever thought they could, and then they're on top of the mountain at the end. And it's like, people love that kind of form of storytelling, and I think, like you said, it kind of goes beyond just regular sports fans.
So I want to go back to the audience bit, and I think that you said it's like mostly men over 35, and okay, the main way you've grown your audience, right, is through organic search. I don't know if you've run ads or anything else. So I guess first question is like organic search, SEO, basically how you've brought everyone to your website, and then people on your website sign up for your newsletter. Is that basically the flow?
So the newsletter, surprisingly, has not really been built a ton through organic search. I've actually been running a lot of Facebook ads over the past year to grow my newsletter audience. And that's why it kind of skews older, because Facebook is that older audience. Yeah, that's kind of how I approached it, is like, SEO is not forever. Like, we know, like, that traffic might not last. Google can cut that off at any time. So I'm trying to focus on monetizing that, but also converting that into an owned audience of my newsletter.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, okay, before we get into the newsletter a bit, I want to tell you about the different platforms you're on. So you started with the website, and I imagine you kind of just set up like a domain kind of blog thing. back after you graduated college, and that was your start. And then newsletter, you said kind of 2019, 2020, and then you have the Twitter, which has about like 1600 followers. Instagram has like 400. And then the Facebook though has 15,000, which you were just talking about how you run Facebook ads and such. But yeah, Facebook to me, like I haven't been on there since 2018, 2017. I just, you know, stopped using it one day. But, and most people I talk to are like, oh, focus on Instagram or Twitter or TikTok or whatever. But I thought it was really interesting that it's like still like your posts get pretty good and like authentic engagement, whereas so much of Facebook is like an AI swamp of like AI commenters engaging with AI posters, etc. So I guess I want to talk about just what these different platforms do for you. And so I think you're on, yeah, you've got your website, newsletter, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and that's everything you're on, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm fully transparent. I'm pretty much a one man band. I have freelance writers from time to time that help me out. I've had the fortune of having some good ones that I've been able to lean on a little bit with some story assignments. But otherwise, it's basically me running the ship. I'm the last person to touch every article, every newsletter that goes out, every social post. So I've kind of had to streamline the process the best way that I could.
Yeah.
So, you know, Facebook was something I ignored, like you said, for a long time. And I would just kind of post my links there directly to stories. Twitter, I tried so hard so many times for so many years, and people were telling me like, write threads, this and that. And it's like the only traction I've gotten on Twitter was through my personal account. And it's mainly just through sharing like updates on my business and like how I'm building things. And
that's what I see, you know, from you.
Stories have never taken off. So I'm kind of just putting Twitter as like, okay, I'll mention people like to follow my updates on the business. And I try not to be like a preachy type of like cringe Twitter account. So I just try to like be transparent about like, mistakes I've made. And yeah. So Facebook is something over the past, like I would say year and a half, 2 years, that has really been my only really social channel that's actually worked. I get a lot of engagement there. Like you said, like, it's just amazing the reach you can get. I had a handful of stories that I constantly like recycle every 6 months, and they get like one of them, I think, got like 5 or 6 million impressions just out of nowhere. Like I posted it on a Friday. I checked on like Saturday afternoon or Saturday night, and it was like 3 or 4 million impressions, and it was just going crazy. So I don't know how that happened, but it's happened like multiple times.
What was the story? Like, do you know what the story was?
It was Edgar Martinez, who was a Seattle Mariners player with a really inspiring story. And it was just kind of like, I just basically pasted like 1,000-word article into Facebook with like an image. And I make these like quote images in Canva.
Yeah.
And that's basically my style, is like, I'll just post like the long form story as a post, and then maybe like link to the article in the comments. But basically the content is basically the same thing across all platforms. So it took off, and I've just kind of been doing that from now on, of like every long form story I write, I try to make at least like 2 posts on Facebook and Instagram out of it. I could definitely be doing better with social, but it's just a matter of like how much time I have.
Yeah.
But yeah, Facebook is, I think, an untapped market nowadays. I think a lot of people overlook it, but it could be worth a test for any business.
I mean, there's still, you know, 1 billion people on there or whatever. So speaking of time, and obviously, yeah, you have a full-time job. I think you do have like some consultancy work you do on the side, and you have this. How much time do you spend on Joker Mag and the Underdog newsletter all told every week?
That's a great question. It's typically like, I would say, an hour and a half, 2 hours before work in the morning. If it's not
every
a day that I go to the gym if it's not a day that I go to the gym, like it'll be, I get up like 6:30, 7 o'clock. I'll work on it for like an hour, go to the gym, come back, start my day of work. I work at a travel company as an SEO specialist. I'm blessed to be fully remote, so it allows me a lot of freedom. During lunch, I might have my computer with me, like just sitting out there, like either reading an article or like kind of like catching up with one of my writers or something like that. And like you mentioned, I do some freelance consulting as well. So, you know, I was never great at time management in like high school and stuff, but I think the college athletic background really did help me. Like when you have a packed schedule, like you're forced to make decisions of like what to prioritize. So, I've gotten a lot better. And I think that's where I'm kind of just doing as much as I possibly can to earn the revenue to put back into growing the business that I care most about, which is Joker Mag.
I always ask people this question about quantifying how much time they spend on it per week. And nobody really has a good answer, which is fair. I don't think I would either, but I want to stick on this for a second. So you said, like, let's say 5 days of work a week, about an hour and a half before. So that's five, that's like 7.5 hours. And then, you know, maybe the lunch, maybe it's like half an hour during lunch every day. So now we're at like 10 hours a week. And then, like, I don't know, like, where do you think it, you don't have to put an exact number, but is it like more or less than 15 per on an average week hours, you would say?
I would say 10 to 15 max.
Yeah.
Like last Saturday, I didn't have any plans. So I just spent like 4 or 5 hours writing the newsletter because I hadn't caught up on things. And so sometimes there will be a day like that, like a Saturday morning, I'll get up early and just crank through the work that I have left. But when I'm not working on it, like physically making progress on something, I'm constantly thinking about things like how to grow my audience or a better story to tell or a, you know, better way to do things. I'm always like kind of thinking about my priorities and how to spend my time and really just blow this thing up. Like I've been working on it, like you said, for, I guess, 6.5 years now since 2017. So I'm really trying to stay patient, but I'm also trying to grow it as much as possible and turn it into a sustainable business. I would say the biggest catalyst recently that happened was in October. I got accepted into Mediavine, which is a high quality display ad network. So I've been able to monetize the website a lot better than it was in the past.
How do you get accepted? What's the criteria for getting accepted?
So you need to get to 50,000 sessions in a month. I think it was like 30 days. I don't know. But to get there, it was just a lot of work with grinding out, you know, kind of these search friendly articles that are going to pick up a lot of traction in organic search. I ran kind of some Facebook traffic ads too, to like get me over the hump. Cause I was like so close for so many months of like 48,000, 49,000. I'm like, okay, I'm just going to push the pedal to the metal here on Facebook and just like gun
invest
it down
a little bit. And then you'll get the financial, like ongoing financial reward that you can then reinvest into more. It's just a circle of ads.
It's a constant cycle. And like, I've never been great at like the number side as well, yeah, like I said, but I've gotten a lot better of like doing these things has made me so much better at like managing cash flow and like knowing where to invest and when, and like how much cash do I have on hand to put into this and that. And how do I prioritize advertising versus content? Cause content is the business. So I'm still trying to figure that out and working things through, but I think I have a much better process than I did a year ago today.
Yeah. I mean, it goes back to that athlete mindset of just trying the thing and, you know, fall down, get back up, et cetera. One more thing about the Mediavine. I'm curious, you don't have to share like your exact revenue numbers. If you're comfortable with it, that's great. But I am curious, like maybe like a unit cost or something. Like, I just want to get some idea of like what that generates for you.
Yeah, so RPM wise, I'm seeing between $18 and $20 RPMs,
which is like revenue per mil or
revenue,
like
revenue per thousand sessions. I think that's based on. Every any given month, I'm seeing between 35 and like 45,000 sessions and like 50K plus page views. So whatever the math is on that.
Yeah.
But in the past, my RPMs were brutal. Like it was like $5 or less with like Google AdSense. And I tried all these other networks and they slowed down my website and like they weren't worth the money. So I kind of like stopped running ads for a while, but I've always heard about like Mediavine being like the gold standard. So when I got accepted, I was thrilled. And now I've been even more blown away by like the potential of it. So now I'm really focused on growing that traffic and growing that revenue, but also keeping in mind like that might not last forever and I want to own my audience on my newsletter. But there's just the challenge I would say for me is like monetization of the newsletter. Like I'm kind of in that in between, like between 10 and 20,000 subscribers. I'm not large enough to get like big deals and I'm kind of like running like through ad network, affiliate deals, direct deals when I have them. But my goal is to eventually ramp up the monetization of the newsletter as well.
So it sounds like you are spending money on like the main way you get newsletter subscribers is through ads. So every, you know, you've spent money on it, you haven't made money. So besides just like increasing service area for ads, do you have any other ideas of how to, or how you're going to monetize it?
Yeah, so I mentioned the book. I'm trying to toy with the idea of like my own products. I have merch, and I've really haven't pushed it too hard.
I see you posting on Twitter. You like post pictures of people in it and stuff, and people. It seems like the people who buy it really resonate with your brand and with you, and so that seems like a positive thing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very positive, and I sell it like just at enough of a margin to like cover the cost basically and the shipping. Just because it's like people are going out of their way to buy like my brand and wear it around.
It's marketing for you.
I look at it. Exactly. So I want to, you know, get it as low of a cost as possible for my true fans. But it hasn't like taken off as like a monetization source. It's more of like sporadic, like someone that loves my newsletter will buy something if I mention it in the newsletter.
Yeah.
But the book is something I'm really passionate about. And I think it's going to be, it has the potential to be really cool. I don't even care if two people buy it. Like, I just want a physical copy of like all
like
the best stories
thing
that I've written. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Just like something to have, like to physically hold in my hands of like a culmination of all the work I've put in. Just for me, it would be cool. And I'm going to try to pre-sell it to my audience and just see how it performs and then figure it out from there of like how to actually go about fulfilling everything. Like, I need to kind of, I was honestly like up pretty late last night, like thinking about all this, like sitting up in bed, like how am I going to actually approach like releasing a book?
Yeah.
But the first draft is basically done, and I'm just kind of now trying to figure out the next step. So if anyone listening to this has any tips, that would be amazing.
Besides like, obviously, you know, a lifetime of like following sports and 6.5 years of working on this, how long have you been actively working on the book?
Probably 3 or 4 months now since I decided like I'm going to try this.
But it's a lot
it's
of
been
it
a lot of like
is writing you've already done and published on the website in the newsletter, right?
So a lot of the chapters are going to be like repurposed versions of stories that I've already published. And then I've done four now exclusive stories. So just for the book only. And I just kind of want to give that those little nuggets to like the true fans who are going to buy things and from me, because, you know, they're spending their hard earned cash on something I've created. And so just kind of a little thing for them of, you know, this is something you haven't read before.
Yeah. I want to go back a little bit quickly to the content on the site and such and working with other writers. You said before that you had worked with other writers. I listened to a bit of a podcast yesterday with this guy, Johnny Podcasts, who on that, he said he'd written for you. And it sounded like it was a really positive experience for him. He was like able to write about sports stories, and you have another, you know, a stable of writers. I don't know. So I'm curious about how long you've been working with other people on the content. Like, when did it stop being just you? Some more questions around that too. But when did you start working with other people?
I think around in the very beginning, it was like friends from college that were like interested in that I was doing something. So they were like, oh, I'll write for you, whatever. And I obviously didn't have anything to pay them. So it was all volunteer.
Yeah, well, you weren't making money yet either from it.
Exactly. So it was just kind of, you know, I go back and I thank them like all the time. Like, some of their posts still get views and stuff like that. So it's really cool. But over the years, I've gone through like many different writers. It wasn't until probably 2020 or 2021 that I really consistently started working with people, and like having kind of a regular cadence of at least like one or two articles a month coming from a freelancer. So I've had the privilege to work with a lot of really good writers. And the guy you mentioned, Johnny, is a really big like podcast producer down in Texas. And we came across each other's stuff. I used to listen to his podcasts. Turns out he played college basketball, was really interested in the NBA. At the time, I wanted some more NBA content. So we kind of got connected. And that's usually how things work out, is it's like organically, like someone will reach out to me or I'll reach out to them and say like, hey, are you interested? Like, I can pay you a flat rate per article. And, you know, we'll go from there. So yeah, it's been really great. I found some really solid writers that are very in touch with the brand and like what we're trying to do, and really aligned with like the vision and the mission behind everything.
Yeah. Two-part question. What's the biggest challenge about doing this and working with these other writers and making sure their work is like the quality you want, et cetera? So what's the biggest challenge? And then what's most gratifying about working with other people in this capacity?
To answer your second question first, the most gratifying thing is like offloading some work for myself.
Yeah.
It's like, man, it feels great when you just get like a whole like 1200 word article sent to you on a platter. And it's like, man, like, this is my work for the week is done. Like, I don't need to worry about the newsletter this Sunday. But yeah, the biggest challenge I think is just like aligning what I'm looking for with like what the writer sees. And I think I've done a much better job of like refining like that voice into fitting like our brand. Like I said, research is very important to us, and we want to go the extra mile for our readers because, you know, we're the home of the underdog. We want to tell the best possible underdog story about each person that we cover. And I think just kind of like iteration over time, like the first article isn't always going to be the best, yeah. But like the 10th, 15th, 20th time, it's going to come out much better. So, yeah, I try to strike the balance of like not being too much of a pain to my writers, but also like making sure that everything aligns with what we're putting out to our readers.
Yeah, which is hard. I feel like in my experience too, you got to get really good at writing a brief that's like both short enough that they're actually going to read it without their eyes glazing over, but also like that hits on all the points where it's like, here's what you need to do. And just setting expectations around like, oh, we'll do one round of edits or two, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Setting expectations with the brief. What was I going to ask? How did you learn to like to do this, to manage other people and lead people? Like, is this... I noticed, I think in your day job, you have some like a team you manage or something like that. Or was this like a sports thing? I don't know. I'm curious how you, because it's a skill, you know, managing other people, like we were just saying, writing a good brief, whatever. How did you learn to manage other writers?
It's kind of something that I've just like learned over time. I was not very good in the beginning, and I won't say I'm the best now, but it's just kind of balancing between like Joker Mag and then like my day job and consulting stuff. Like I'm always outsourcing stuff to writers. And basically that's like you mentioned, that is a skill that I've kind of learned and developed, but pulling experience from my day job and translating it to Joker Mag and vice versa has been really beneficial because I am focused on a lot of the same things and everything that I'm doing. So I think it's kind of, I was talking to a friend the other day, like it kind of is like a multiplier on like years of experience when you have multiple things going on at once. So, you know, I might have only been in SEO since 2020, but in reality, I have much more experience than the average person who started at the same time that maybe just works, you know, at an agency or whatever. Like I have a lot of different balls in the air, and I think it's really contributed.
And you have skin in the game because this is your thing.
Exactly. Yeah. So like when people ask me about a Google update, it's not like I'm genuinely giving you my answer because I have a website that could be impacted by it. So yeah, I think that's a big part of it too, is having skin in the game, but also just pulling from each experience I have and just getting that 1% better as much as possible.
I would love if you have any advice to share first about SEO and then, and like just having a website with your content, and then newsletters. So yeah, any advice about like having a website, SEO optimized website, whatever, as the home of your content as a creator online.
So like you mentioned in the beginning, SEO has kind of gotten a bad rap from people that don't understand the whole field and the whole industry of SEO. I think a lot of people think that it's about like misleading people or misleading search engines. But at the end of the day, it's just like what you said with your listeners. You want to do people a service. Like when they land on your website, you want to give them exactly what they're looking for. So if I'm searching for just an example for Joker Mag, like shortest NBA players or anything like that, you want to go above and beyond to like answer that call. Like if I rank number one, I should deserve to rank number one because my content is better than every other website that has written about this topic before. So I'm going to go the extra mile with my research. I'm going to answer every possible follow-up question you can have of like, who is the shortest center of all time or whatever, like with any sport. And like drawing on comparison, slicing the data up, like how many people currently are under 6 foot in the NBA and like what positions do they play? So I think it's about like that.
Find all the answers and give them to people.
And deliver them on like a platter for people. Mm-hmm. Make it easy for them to skim the page, like table of contents with jump links. I always recommend to everyone, like if it's longer than 1,000 words and it's got multiple sections, let people jump to the answer that they want. And it doesn't hurt for SEO either, but. I would say with anything, like do your readers a service and make them enjoy the experience of reading your content.
We're doing the newsletter now on and off for a little over 4 years. What have you learned there? What advice would you give to other newsletter creators?
I've come across a lot of different, I think it depends on your business model, but I've come across a lot of different advice of like, should you deliver the meat of the content in the newsletter or should you link out and try to monetize that click? And in my experience, delivering everything in the newsletter itself leads to much more engagement a better reader experience, better reader retention, because you're giving them what they came for. They did you a service essentially by like giving you their contact information, and you want to treat that with the most respect you possibly can. Like, someone's allowing you the privilege of entering their email inbox, and that's like a coveted space for like work stuff and everything. Like, you want to make sure you stay there and you can show up there week after week or whatever your cadence is. So give them the best possible experience, treat them like VIPs, because they are. Mm-hmm. They're your VIP readers. They're not just people that are going to like occasionally retweet a tweet of yours. They're people that are going to show up and read and support everything you have going on every single week. So, not like misleading people, and not like, you want everything to be totally congruent. Like, your messaging from the very beginning, like if I'm running a Facebook ad, personally, my Facebook ad is like a piece of content. So it's like a long form story with a call to action. Like, if you want more stories like this, join my newsletter. They click to join the newsletter. The message is exactly the same. They enter the email. They get land on a thank you message. They get my confirmation email. I deliver more content to them in my confirmation email of like, here's a bonus story because you signed up. And I'm just constantly like trying to make the experience as good as possible from beginning to end. So yeah, I think I ramble a little bit, but that's my
That's good. That's good stuff. Okay, in your numbers guy journey, have you set up like any interesting like segments or automations with the newsletter that you're willing to talk about?
Yeah, so I don't have a ton set up right now. I think I'm leaving a lot of meat on the bone, but I think I am using it more than I originally was. So I have a welcome automation where it's, they get my first welcome email, which I said is like a confirmation, like, thanks for joining. Here's a bonus story for you. And it's like a 1,000-word story with a little sign off. 24 hours later, I have an automation set up to go with my, I call it like my second welcome email, like a greatest hits edition. So it's got all like the original sections that I used to have of like top stories. So it's kind of like aggregating some of my best stuff and highest performing stories in one place. So it's just kind of like, here's the type of stories you can expect to get on this newsletter and stuff like that. And then like kind of introducing like the extra innings section to make sure people always scroll to the bottom.
I'm curious, those greatest hits ones, do people click on those? Like, when you send those out, are people actually like, is the click rate higher than your average email, say?
So it's only when people join the newsletter, they get it at like 24 hours after the welcome email, but it does get a lot more engagement than I expected. Originally I thought like it might come off as like too many emails in like 2 days or whatever, but I've set it up to where like Beehive lets you do a time delay. So I make sure that it never gets sent out on the same day as my regular newsletter, which is Sunday. So if someone joins on like a Saturday, they get my newsletter on that Sunday. And then maybe not till Monday or Tuesday, they get my greatest hits, but it does get a good amount of engagement. I have a couple polls in there too, and they're constantly getting new poll responses too.
Nice. One question that actually has been on my mind for a while. Why is it called Joker Mag?
That's a great question. I have a section on my about page, that just kind of like, it's Joker is like my family's bulldog. He was named by the person that we got him from because he had like a black eye and like reminiscent of the Joker from the Batman movies.
Hence the logo as well.
Hence the logo. Exactly. So he's my mascot. And I just, to be totally honest with you, in the very beginning, I didn't know what I was doing. I was trying to find a domain that was available. And I was like, just blended like two things I thought were cool. But the kind of the story that I tell people is like, he has overcome adversity. He's had like all these different surgeries. And now he's like a peppy little bulldog, getting into his older years now, but he's kind of our mascot and kind of like the symbol of the underdog.
Okay. One more question about monetization, then maybe we'll look into some future facing stuff. So I know it's like deeply a passion project for you. I think you shared that, like, I mean, your favorite thing is when these people reach out to you and are like, this was such a meaningful story to me. You know, it goes back to, that's why you do this in the first place, because you read stories like this that are meaningful to you. So it's like, I think that's really nice. It's like this really nice, earnest, passion driven thing, and that's why you're still doing it 6.5 years later. But eventually money has to come in for you to, you know, keep doing it. And so we talked a little bit about the ads. I know you have kind of a virtual tip jar set up. I'm always curious if people engage with that. Is there any other monetization that I'm missing? And then do you have any like kind of short to midterm monetization plans in the works besides the book?
Yeah, so I've been running a lot of ads through the Beehive Ad Network. It's been an awesome tool to have at my disposal to fill up any inventory that I have open. I've done a lot of like direct stuff where not just cross promotions, but like flat rate sponsorships where a brand will pay or another newsletter will pay to get in front of my audience. And my goal in the short term is to bring up the newsletter monetization to in line with the website monetization. So that I think is a very realistic goal given the size and the growth trajectory that I'm on right now. But right now I'm pretty much running, I guess, a break even, if you look at it that way, of like investing the
besides your time
ad revenue. Exactly. Besides my time. So investing the ad revenue into the Facebook ads to grow and then some content, I guess content kind of makes it go a little bit over, but, I'm much better off than I was, I would say, a year ago today in terms of revenue. But I think newsletters in general, like I think the whole monetization gap between websites and newsletters, like newsletters still have a ways to go to catch up. And I think Beehive is kind of at the forefront of that. So that's why I'm really excited to be on the platform. But I think, yeah, I'm really optimistic about like newsletter monetization going forward in general.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, so you told me that your kind of short-term goals, I think for the end of this year, are to grow the newsletter to 50,000 engaged subscribers and the site to 100,000 monthly page views. So the newsletter one, that's like a 2.5 times growth, whereas the site one is like a 2 times growth. You know, pretty like those are good reach goals, but I think it's going to be tough to reach them.
Yeah.
How do you plan to achieve those? You can break it down like newsletter first, then website if it's different. But yeah. How do you plan to 2.5 times your newsletter subscribers this year and 2 times your page views on your website?
So basically earning more revenue to reinvest in growth. I want to double what I'm spending on Facebook ads to grow, and still stay at least at break even. And find more ways, more levers to monetize my audience. I think the book will be a big telling thing for me. Because if I can sell a physical product that people want, I can sell digital products that people want, maybe exclusive insights, maybe a premium newsletter. I'm not closing off the idea of that, but I think like more, like I want to be more in control of my revenue by like selling direct to my audience. So I just think I need to iterate and figure out things that are going to work that people actually want. And people have been very supportive of my sponsors, so I'm not against the ad-based model either. But I think just I need to reach that critical mass point where like the website, once I got to 50,000, it unlocked a huge, you know, increase in revenue. And like I was making a bigger multiple on like every reader that comes to my site. So I think it's just a matter of like reaching that critical mass of like, say 50,000 subscribers or 25,000 subscribers, whatever it may be, like to kind of unlock that potential. Whereas like right now I'm kind of,
and then there's like the word of mouth.
Exactly. Like right now I'm kind of like fighting for like scraps in terms of like my newsletter monetization compared to my website. But I think I'm confident that like once I get to a certain point, audience wise and engagement wise, it'll kind of take care of itself.
What do you think is the single biggest obstacle standing between you and like not even just these short term goals, but like long term? I know you have ambitious goals of like make this a full on media company, and this is your full time job. You've got a team of writers, you're on all the platforms, etc. What are the biggest things standing between you and like your more long term ambitious goals with this?
I think time. I think I need to unlock the time to like grow this. And I think I found a better system to streamline production of content and growth and stuff like that. But like realistically, the more time I could focus on this and like hyper laser in on exactly what I'm trying to accomplish, I think just having the time to like sit back and look at it from a high level perspective, and like figure out the next step. I think I'm on the right path, and I think it's just about executing day after day. And it might not be like the sexiest approach, but it's what's been working for me. So I'm going to stay on that path, but also dedicating time to just like thinking about my business. I think like getting out of the day to day of like
how important that is.
Yeah. And I think that is important because it's like something that keeps me up at night sometimes of like, I need to think about my business, but I haven't had time all day to do it. So, I think that is the big part of it for me, is just like having a more strategic, not that I'm not strategic right now, but like having that extra time to like breathe and be more strategic with like where I want to take this 3 to 5 year plan going forward.
Yeah. I think it's funny what you say about like you know, the staying up at night worrying about like not, you know, taking the time. I feel like I will often have that too, where I'm like, you know, spending like 2 hours trying to fall asleep thinking about like X thing I need to do, et cetera. But then it's like hard to find the time in your day to actually sit down and like do that kind of thinking and write it down. It's, I never really thought about that before. Anyways, a couple more questions. We've been doing this for 6.5, almost 7 years. What is the biggest mistake or regret running this in those almost 7 years?
Spreading myself too thin. I think I split my focus far too much. And I think even today, like I'm kind of guilty of that as well, of like trying to take too many things on my plate, like in terms of like in the very beginning, I was like, okay, I have this website. I know I want this to be like my forever thing, but like I need to make other money online. So I tried, like I tested the waters of Facebook ads for like drop shipping products and like all this like ClickFunnels stuff in the beginning when that was going on. And it's like, I've kind of bought into, like, in the beginning, I was like guilty of just like buying into like the hot new shiny object instead of just like zeroing in on like what I really want to do long term. So I think a lot of people still are guilty of that. And I think I see it a lot on Twitter and stuff, like where someone will brand themselves as like this person. And then a month later, they'll be someone else. Like they'll go from like SEO to like email marketing. And then all of a sudden they're doing like Facebook ads. And it's like, I think just narrowing my focus on like, okay, SEO and newsletter, that's it. And just fully be dedicated to that. And just the more you can zero in on that one thing or one or two things, the better you'll get, instead of just spreading yourself across 5 or 10 different things and just trying to make a little bit of progress.
Yeah. Which again is why you're, you know, you're active on Facebook as well, but not, you don't need to be on all the other social platforms, because then that'll just make everything worse. Okay. What's your favorite piece that you've written? Favorite piece of content you've ever put out under the Joker Mac project?
So I would say my most recent story, one of my most recent stories that I'm really proud of is Quantez Stiggers is a guy who never played college football. His father passed away in the beginning of his college career, and he left college. He was working for DoorDash and all this stuff, and then eventually came back to football through this obscure indoor football league that came about. And his mother actually like secretly signed him up for it and didn't even tell him about it until the day before the tryouts. And now he just got drafted by the New York Jets. And
oh, it's
like
so
2 or 3 years later. So just an amazing story. And like, it was something I came across before kind of the whole news cycle hit it. It was in February that I published it. And then of course, when the NFL draft came around in April, it was like the hot news story on like the big time publications. But I think I pride myself in like finding those like hidden gem stories and talking about them, maybe if not before others, because it's so competitive right now. Like everyone's on top of these things, but talking about it more in depth and like uncovering those like little nuggets of information that are going to make that story 1% better than other people that have told the same story.
What you were talking about reminded me of another story of yours that I read yesterday. I forget the guy's name. He was like the GM for the Philly.
Yeah, Howie Roseman.
Yeah. And I think it reminded me of you a lot, where it's like, I mean, you actually played sports, but in this one, it's like he never played the sports. He just like, as a kid, he just wanted to be the GM. And I feel like this, like obviously sports has your entire life been so important to you. And I think like this is your route. Like this is your Roseman thing, right? Like you don't necessarily want to be a GM, but you want to be like, you want to work in sports media, and like this is your way. And like, no matter what, like you're going to overcome whatever it is, like time and like, you know, laying every brick and brick and brick until you've got like, you know, the 50,000 newsletter subscribers this year, et cetera. I don't know. Yeah. Is there like, I guess my question is, there like, is it Roseman or is there some other figure that like is your personal like underdog hero? Cause there's so many, like, hundreds that you've gone through. Like, do you have a personal like favorite story that just resonates the most with you?
I would say there's a guy I wrote about in my book, and I think it's going to be like a book exclusive, but I would say he without a doubt has like the best underdog story I've ever encountered. And it's going to be like the first chapter of my book. But I read he wrote a book about his life story, like not a very well-known book, not a very well-known name, but like his story just like was absolutely incredible. So like, long story short, hopefully I get everything right, but just kind of a summary of like, he was born in Brooklyn. His mother was severely addicted to drugs. He didn't have a father. And he was kind of like the caretaker. He had like a bunch of siblings and he was the oldest of them. And his mother would go out and like be up to no good. And he would kind of have to be like the father figure for his siblings. And in the meantime, like he found an escape through football and just like became a great player. But like, he wasn't even allowed to join the football team in the beginning because his mother and all his responsibilities at home were so much, like he couldn't even make the time for organized sports. And eventually, like through like great coaches that were looking out for him, he made his way onto playing college football. Even during then, like his mother passed away, his stepdad passed away, like he encountered so much adversity and still made it to the NFL. And like he was from a small school and just everything was completely stacked against him. And like anytime I think about like making an excuse for myself or, you know, finding a reason not to do something, it's like you think of a guy like that and it's like he had every excuse to not make his dream come true and he still did. And he made it to the highest level. He, I think he was the first person to return a punt for a touchdown in the entire history of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers in the NFL. And now like his family's taken care of, he's taken care of all his siblings. He's done everything he possibly could accomplish in his life. And, you know, he's living a happy life now in retirement, but it's like stuff like that. It just really hits you because like I said, it is like people have this like extra level of motivation or whatever it is innately in them to overcome whatever is thrown their way. And I think that's, to me, like that's the most inspiring thing of like seeing other people overcome things. And it makes kind of makes like your problems look a little bit smaller, a little bit more surmountable in your own life. So that's what I love most. And I think recently that's probably the best story that I've covered.
That's a good one. I think too that I feel like we're all underdogs in this capitalist society, you know, struggling to monetize our newsletters, etc. is what I take away from that. Starting to monetize our newsletters and retire our families. Anyways, I think that about covers it. Is there anything else we haven't talked about that you want to get into before we do some closing things?
No, I think the biggest thing that I like, the biggest message of mine on Twitter, I hope that comes across to people is like, I don't have everything figured out. I'm just learning day to day. And I think never take anyone's opinion too seriously, like just because they have a blue check mark or whatever it is, or they have 500,000 followers, like it doesn't mean their opinion is right. And it doesn't mean their opinion is right for you specifically. I never would have even considered trying Facebook for my newsletter if I listened to everyone else that said Facebook was dead or long form. People don't like long form stories in an email, like send them a link instead. Like my newsletter wouldn't be where it is today. So, and not to say that it's like a lights out amazing newsletter, but it's getting better each week. And I think just like following your own path is the biggest message I want to hammer home.
Yeah. But actually following it every day, step by step. Okay. Where should people find you or your newsletter?
JokerMag.com. There's a sign up box there. I also just set up my custom web domain. You don't have to plug that though. It's newsletter.jokermag.com. But everything's under the Joker Mag brand. You can sign up for the newsletter and just read our articles if you want to. I appreciate any support or any advice or any feedback you have for any of your listeners.
Sick. Well, hit them up, people. This has been the Creator Spotlight Podcast. I'm your host, Francis Zier. My guest today was Tyler O'Shea, the man behind Joker Mag. Thank you, Tyler, for joining me. Thank you, listener, for sticking around. And if you enjoyed this episode, it would mean a lot if you rated us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. I'll see you next week.